So there's a tension that's set up these days in our media and in I guess the way we talk to one another, definitely there in high schools, that there is a combat between religion and science. Now, it is certainly true to say that some expressions of religion are very hostile towards scientific discovery. And there are some scientific pursuits that seem to have in mind the taking to pieces of religion. Indeed, in our day, there are many in the scientific community who have absolutely no time for any faith, thought, or discussion whatsoever. And this bothers me. This bothers me because historically, this is an unusual thing. To have a group of people in some human endeavor, such as science or, you know, social studies or whatever, then say that some other group of human beings with another concern are completely wasting their time is exceptionally rare. So, this idea of the atheist scientist, perhaps typified especially by Richard Dawkins, is a new thing. It's a brand spanking new thing. I don't know if any of you have read any Richard Dawkins books. I know that some people of faith come to Richard Dawkins books a bit scary. You know, they feel like they're going into the head teacher's office and they've just been caught. Okay? I don't know why you ended up at the head teacher's office at your school, but certainly counting the number of tiles away from the urinal you could start peeing from was one of them in our school. I have to say that's the closest I ever got to being belted. And if you're too young to know what that is, talk to your teacher. Do you know what the teachers these days who are teaching our kids didn't even have to face the belt? We're getting old, us people who got brutalized at school. So, you pick up your Richard Dawkins book and you read it and you think, oh no, he's going to take my faith to bits. And you read it and you actually find out two things. The first thing you find out is Richard Dawkins is a brilliant scientist. He's an excellent geneticist. His understanding of the biology of genetics is brilliant. I have to tell you though, he is an appalling theologian. Rubbish. He wouldn't get an F minus. The only people who read Dawkins and say he's a brilliant theologian are other people who share his opinions, which you always got to be a little bit suspicious of. Indeed, Dawkins is so poor at theology that some other atheist scientists say, for goodness sake, Richard, stop writing books, okay? Write books about genetics. Now, he's perfectly entitled to write his books, and they're tremendously successful. I don't have time to go through the God delusion and things of that nature to have a look at some of the difficulties there. But needless to say, that if you're a person of genuine faith, it's unlikely to give you a heart attack. Why? Because faith and science are not enemies. They are different endeavors. Okay? A Christian does not have anything to fear from good science. Indeed, good science has often been done by people of faith. The vast majority of scientists throughout history have been people of faith of one sort or another. One of the most famous disputes between the church and science was between the Vatican and Copernicus and Galileo. Copernicus suggested that the center of the universe was not the earth, it was the sun. Galileo takes this idea on. What many of the accounts fail to communicate, though, is that both Copernicus and Galileo were Christians. And what the debate was over was, how do we interpret the scriptures? How do we interpret what it says in Genesis? How do we interpret what it says in Proverbs 8, which is a lesser-known creation story? How do we figure this stuff out? And the Vatican said, we want it this way, and that had a received understanding. And it was challenged by another Christian in Galileo. Now, he lost his life in those discussions. And there's all sorts of reasons for that that I won't go into just now, but you need to know that he was a person of faith. Isaac Newton was a person of faith, very weird kind of faith. He was a deist. He believed that God created the world and then went off to play golf. But he did see a world in which things happened as a mechanism set up. In fact, he said something quite profound about the mechanism of the eye. He said, nobody can look at the mechanism of the eye and he didn't know the 11 discrete biochemical reactions that are needed to take a photon of light and turn it into a perception in your brain. And I've told you before, those 11 biochemical reactions, I can't even communicate to you. I can't read the names. I look at them. Chemists can. I can't. And I proclaim no expertise in that. But what I can tell you is if any one of those tiny bits of pieces are missing, then when that photon hits the retina, it doesn't get seen as light. And we know this because some people lose their sight because these reactions break down. Newton said you cannot look at an eyeball and doubt that it was created, made. Here's Einstein. Now, Einstein was Jewish in background. He did not believe in a personal God. I wouldn't get him to lead a Bible study. However, he did say this: science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. He talked about science being looking into the thoughts of God. Because as he has studied the universe, he saw patterns and shape and structure that were more indicative of design than the logo on your Starbucks cup or indeed the production of a motor vehicle. Both relatively simple things compared to the grandeur of wider creation. And as he worked through his theory of general relativity, he was doing so fully expecting he was unraveling the structure of a universe that was made. Now, you may still disagree with that, although, to be fair, I think most people in a church on a Sunday morning are unlikely to be atheists. However, we may have one or two, and if you are, deep respect to you, because this, I don't know, someone must have paid you. Now, but we have nothing to fear from good science. I want to take us into something that's been happening in these days. This is, okay, I'm only going to say the long name once, all right? This is Churyumov Gerasimenko 67P, from now on known as 67P, which is about what you have to pay for a Mars bar these days in these unbelievably expensive times. 67P is a comet. And for those of you who've been watching your television screens, you might have seen news articles drift across about this comet. Now, this is another picture of it. I like this picture because you can just start to see here the start of the tail. The tail of a comet is what happens as a comet heats. Comets tend to journey into the deep expanses of space where it is phenomenally cold. But as they draw nearer to the sun's radiation starts to cause some of the comet's material to heat up and effectively to bubble off. We also now know that it causes some of the material on the comet to leave the comet, and then it comes back to the comet as it cools down. It's absolutely fascinating. The tail of a comet doesn't follow the comet. The tail of a comet points directly away from the sun. It's the solar radiation that causes the comet's tail to form. And a comet tail is ordinarily about 500 million kilometers long. That's why we can see it from Earth. So those of you who got sighted about Halley's Comet the last time it went past, or the other one, I can't remember. Now, human endeavor has visited five comets previous to this one, passing through the tail, getting close, having a look. But nobody has managed to do what's happened in these last days. Now, just to give, before we do this, what is a comet? A comet is effectively a bit of space debris. It's something that's left over. Our best guess would be is they're the bits and pieces that are left over after the formation of the planets, and that the gravitational pull of the planets and the sun have not been able to draw these together into the planets. They're different from asteroids in that asteroids are largely made up of rock. Comets have a different chemical composition, and they contain methane and a rather large amount of water, and this appears to be confirmed by the initial data. So they're different from asteroids. The asteroid belt as we have it in the solar system goes around the it, it, it mostly is around the sun. Every now and then one comes out of there. But comets follow these enormous orbits. We'll have a look at the moment about what's had to be done to get to the comet. Just to give you an idea of size, here is 67P over London. So if the Tower of London's here, and Big Ben in what the Elizabeth II Tower, and then we now have to call it, this is what this comet would look like. Prompting thoughts of, oh my goodness me, what would happen if one of those hit the Earth? Some scientists reckon about 65 million years ago that the Gulf of Mexico was created by an impact from a comet not unlike this or an asteroid. It's called the Chicxulub event, but you can read about that on Wikipedia at your leisure. Okay? Might have wiped out the largest of the dinosaurs. Boom. So, the European Space Agency, did you know we had one? Okay, if you knew we had one, give yourself a pat on the back. All right, so whatever UKIP manages to do, there is a European Space Agency. I'm not sure that Nigel Farage will be particularly delighted about that because it spends money. How dare it? But the thing is space exploration is extraordinarily expensive. And so it's one of the things we can do cooperatively. So many of the head people are Germans. The base is in Madrid. There's lots of British scientists work. The project manager, well, some of the project managers for this particular mission are British. The origins of this space mission are 25 years old. So the people who started this particular endeavor to go visit Comet 67P started to think about and plan the mission 25 years ago. The year before I got married. So, think about that. Think what you can do in that length of time. Have a couple of girls. So, they started planning, and I've got my wee fact sheet here. It was in November of 1993 that approval was given by the European Space Agency to the Horizons 2000 science program. They initially were going to go to another comet, but there was delays in the program, and so they had to change target, and 67P became their target. 67P moves through space at about 40,000 miles an hour, somewhere around there. Actually, it's probably kilometers. It'll be 40,000 kilometers an hour. So here's what had to happen to get the spaceship that was made. By the way, I better go back and... That is the Rosetta orbiter here. These large solar panels and this kind of black fridge and a sky dish. All right? Very expensive black fridge and a sky dish, but that's... and this is a little bit we'll be having to look at in a bit. But this is the Rosetta orbiter. So it was launched by an Ariane rocket in 2003, was it? Or is it 2004? I've got to get this right. Oh, it says on this slide. 2004 in March. That's when it took off. Okay? And set off on its journey. And this is the route that it's been on. I can't see my wee red thing. Here we go. So here's Earth. Here's the Sun. And this is the comet's orbit. See how far it goes out into the solar system. And like many comets, it doesn't orbit in the plane of the planets. It orbits at a... it's got an elliptical orbit, which brings it close to the sun and then far away from the sun. And here are the various moments. It's launched in 2004. In June 2011, so 7 years after it being launched, it's so far from the sun that those big solar panels can no longer power it, so it goes into standby mode, all right? For 2.5 years, and they're trying to get contact with this thing. And then in January of this year, it comes out of hibernation. Talk about a squeaky bum bit of the season. You kind of, can you imagine they're sort of going, I hope so, I hope so, I hope so. Just guys sitting at computers and girls sitting at computers just waiting for this thing to wake up. It woke up, arrived at 67P in August, and then started a series of fancy maneuvers. If you want to know more about this, I couldn't recommend more than go to the European Space Agency's website. This is the Philae lander. This weighs about 100 kilograms, So about the same as me and a rucksack. You imagine me as a scout now. And this landed on the surface of the comet. No one has ever managed to do this before. You may know the story that the lander knew that one of the rockets that pushed the lander into the comet wasn't working, and they decided to go for it anyway. And what they eventually figured out happened was the wee Philae lander started to come down, and that's it. That's a genuine photograph. So it's left the Rosetta space, the space probe, and it's heading down towards the surface. Now, because Comet 67P has gravity a 1/10,000th of Earth, the effective weight of this 100 kilograms is about a gram. Okay? So it's about as much... I was going to make a joke there, but I'm going to try not to. Okay? So we're talking less than a feather. So it drifts down, and the rocket that was supposed to push it into the ground failed, and the harpoons that hold it to the surface, they appeared to fail as well. So it bounced. So it hits the surface and it heads up again, and it heads up 1,000 meters and comes down again and up. All this meant it didn't land where it was supposed to. It landed in shadow. The other thing is it was suspected. They knew that 67P had an irregular shape, but never did they imagine it had so many crevasses and cliffs and stuff. That's a completely unexpected feature of the comet. This is 40 meters up. This is the real thing of the surface of Comet 67P. So nobody knew. They knew it was a regular shape, but they had no idea that it was this shape. And they're all excited because they go, oh, it's not just one nucleus, it's two nucleuses. Or maybe it's just in the middle that it gives off its, you know, most of its stuff. And they land the lander on it. And for 64 hours, these instruments are collecting data. So there's all sorts of instruments. There's something to drill down. There's something to analyze the dust on the surface. They're obviously taking analysis of the gas that surround the comet. I hope you're enjoying this. So, need a Rollo. Now, how does this information get back to Earth? This is a radio telescope. Okay? This could pick up capital radio on Mars, no bother. That's what it is. It scans the skies for very weak radio signals. Now, all radio signals are kind of like light, but it's way, way away from what we can see. And that's how the information gets back to Earth. It takes quite a while. You really don't want, you know, you don't want a nervous person controlling this, because their instructions, you know, it takes about 30 minutes both ways. But this information gets back to Earth through radio telescopes. This is a particularly famous radio telescope in Australia. This is the Parkes Dish. Has anyone ever seen the film The Dish with Sam Neill? Okay, three of you. Well done. It's a good film, and it's cheap on DVD because nobody watched it. So, you know, it's a complete bargain you'll get from Amazon for less than a pint. And they didn't actually use this dish because there's another dish in Australia that looks better. But this is a proper one. This is the Parkes Dish. Now, the Parkes Dish will be, I don't know if it's assigned to the Rosetta mission or not, but I do know that it was assigned to this mission, Apollo 11, which is the first time that we ever sent people to the moon. And the Apollo 11 mission in 1969, it was July the 20th in the States, but it was July the 21st in Australia, which was a year before I was born, okay? Which is why I prefer the Australian date. Because someone celebrated the moon landing by having me. And Apollo 11's data came back through that Parkes radio telescope. Much, much, much closer, I just hasten to add. The moon's about 400,000 miles away, well, about 600,000 kilometers. Comet 67P is currently half, you know, it's an enormous, half a billion kilometers away. So, Apollo 11. Why am I bringing that up? Because I met one of the guys who was on that listening station on July the 21st, 1969. His name's John Saxon. He worked with my dad building nuclear missiles. I know, it's a long story. Anyway, and so I had a chat with John, and John said, here, Mark, have a look at this. This is Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin's heart rate monitor traces from 1969, and here was their heart rates and stuff, and I'm kind of like, great, top pub fact. So I met the guy who was at the station that was getting the information from Apollo 11 a year before I was born. That's how the information gets back, through radio telescopes. And we don't often think about that. We hear about these great things, but there's a whole system that gets that information back. Now you're going, hang on a minute, I'm in a church. We haven't read from the scriptures. Nothing's happened. We're just talking about this mission to a comet and the 64 hours of data that we got from the Philae lander that came from the Rosetta orbiter because of the European Space Agency's mission that was birthed 25 years ago to get something to a comet. All for 64 hours of data. Now, the orbiter is going to give us a bit more, and it might be as the comet gets closer to the sun, the wee lander will wake up again. But at the moment, it's in standby mode. It's run out of juice because it's in the shadow of one of these cliffs, and they can't get any more information about it. What the hang has that got to do with church? Well, I've told you that science and religion aren't enemies. And sometimes the way that science works and the way that engineering works kind of helps us. And I would remind us that we do have scientists in our midst, and engineers, and people who work with real, genuine stuff and still believe in Jesus. Would you believe it? You see, we're at the end of a four-year voyage. We've been working through this thing called the Four Faces of God. Many of you will not be aware of this. But in the very end of October 2010, we started tracking with this book, The Four Faces of God, written by a guy called John Bickersteth. And what he does is he paints out a picture of the four Gospels, these four different presentations of Jesus' ministry. And we followed with Matthew at the start, and then Mark. We started in 2011, and then 2012 in Advent. We started in Luke, and then 2013 Advent, we started with John. We're just coming to the end of our voyage in John. So we've focused on each of the Gospels. Why have we done this? Because each of them gives a slightly different presentation of Jesus' ministry. Gathering data from, there are birth stories, there's one story from his teenage years, but most of it is about the 3.5 years of his ministry in Galilee and Judea under the Roman occupation round about 30 AD. And those 3.5-year streams of data and the different perspectives provided provide us with important information. And just like in the Philae lander, it's got different sensors for doing different things. There's a drill, there'll be a spectrum analyzer. There's all sorts of different things on board, different experiments set up. So we've got four ways of looking at Jesus. They're very different. Matthew is interested in the Jewish perspective of Jesus arrived as the king, the promised one, the Messiah, the kingdom of heaven. All of the Jewish expectation. Matthew's the one who quotes a lot from the Old Testament. It happens in the other Gospels, but it's especially in Matthew. And he's concerned to say to the Jews, here, Jewish dudes, this is the guy you've been expecting. Mark is concerned about the fact that Jesus comes as a suffering servant, that the king of the universe arrives in the world as someone who serves. So the person who should have got the red carpet and the full treatment and honor, he actually comes as a baby in a manger and serves. So the one who could have demanded our worship serves us like a slave and suffers to rescue us. Luke's view of Jesus is based around this idea that Jesus lives the most amazing human life that there has ever been. Nobody has ever lived a more human life than Jesus. Even though he didn't marry and didn't have kids, and though he didn't, that was a gospel that was written about 150 years later and is about historical as a Hello magazine. So, true. Or for that matter, the Daily Record. There we go. I've made lots of enemies now. But Luke's view of Jesus is the perfect person who lives the ideal human life. And Luke's focused in on that human perspective. Luke himself was a physician. He was a doctor. And whether it was him who wrote it or the community around him, and in fact, Luke's gospel is the first part of Luke Acts, so he looks at the early church as well. Well, we've been tracking with John's view. This is a kind of different, a different experiment on the lander, a different bit of equipment. The data that John's interested in is the stuff that talks about Jesus' divinity. This is Jesus, the Son of God. So yeah, born of somewhere about 4 BC. But who Jesus was more than human. Now that's recognized by the other three Gospels, but John has a real focus on it. And so it's got things like the I Am sayings. Why? Because I Am is the Jewish name for God. It has a focus on Jesus saying, truly, truly, I say to you, amen, amen, I say to you. He's giving them teaching in the way that someone who is in charge would give them teaching. And he talks about his relationship with the Father, and he says, I need to go back to send God as the Holy Spirit among you, so that it's not just me here with you in a room, but I can be with you everywhere. So we got these four different presentations of Jesus' life in the four Gospels. They're like these different experiments. Who here is going to be watching the Grand Prix later? Ta-da! Okay, absolutely. Required watching. Oh, yeah. And this year they've introduced a new camera, which is a heat camera, okay, which you can tell the temperature that's in the tires. All right? When you first looked at it, it was weird because it looked like one of those cheap 1970s Top of the Pops overlays. You remember where everything went funny colors? But obviously what you're looking at is the changing colors of the tires. As they get hotter, they're finding a way to show people who can see how hot it would be if you touched it. So it's kind of, ooh, 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 ouch, right, okay? But it's not smell-o-vision. It doesn't have that built into it, so you have to represent it visually. Now they can overlay it, so you're looking at Rosberg or Hamilton's helmet. So you see them driving down the road, okay, and you can see the heat coming in the tires, and they've overlaid it. That is a perfect representation of what we're talking about here. The four Gospels are like those two different cameras. One camera is saying, this is the road that you're going down. The other camera is saying, look at the heat in the tires. And hot tires equals good adhesion. Two hot tires equals trouble, equals blistering and tire degradation and all that nasty stuff. And so these Gospels are saying, yeah, here's Jesus. But Jesus is the King of the Jews, but he isn't just the King of the Jews. He's also the suffering servant who lays down his life for everybody to rescue us. But he's not just that. He's also the ideal human life that comes to live and show us how to live in God's love. But he's also the divine Son of God who comes among us as a human being. He's not just one of these four things. He's all four of them. And every gospel hints at that, but each gospel has its specific focus to make it clear. I hope that's clear. We're going to have a look at one last story in John's Gospel as we exit our four-year voyage and we've deposited our lander on comet planet, I don't know, John. And just to remind you, there's the real photo that came from, well, that beats all holiday pics in terms of how far it came away. Now, this story comes from John chapter 9. And in John chapter 9, we find Jesus just doing what Jesus does, which is confusing people and transforming people's lives. He did a lot of that when he was about. And John chapter 9, reading from verse 1, is the start of a whole episode when Jesus encounters someone who cannot see. As he went along, we read, he saw a blind man who was blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, that means teacher, who sinned? Is this guy blind because of what he's done, or is he blind because of what his parents have done? Note that idea, you know, something bad's happened to him because they've been bad. Jesus says this, neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus. How does he know? Anyway, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. Having said this, he spat on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, stuck it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. The man's going, oh, yuck, right? So the man went and washed, and he came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg? Some claimed that he was. Others said, nah, he only looks like him. But he himself said, I'm that guy. How then were your eyes open, they demanded. And he replied, the man they called Jesus made some mud, put it on my eyes, told me to go wash in the pool of Siloam. So I went and washed, and then I could see. Where is this man, they asked him. I don't know, he said. Look at that Scooby-Doo quote right in the middle of the scriptures. So this story, it's part of that 3.5-year data stream that comes in, and it's this time we're analyzing it through John's gospel. Here's a man who's born blind, and the people want to find out how come he's blind. How come he's blind? Has he done something wrong? Has his parents done something wrong? And when Jesus said no, he didn't mean that these people were perfect. He just meant he wasn't blind because they'd done something wrong. Now, obviously, if you do wrong things, sometimes there's consequences. But for this person, he was just blind. It's part of the accident that happens in the universe. Jesus refers to this a few times. Sometimes bad things happen, and they happen because that's how the universe is set up. Things happen. It's very interesting that often we want to make purpose out of bad events. And sometimes the scriptures do that. But many times, for Jesus, bad events are just bad events. It's how we respond to them. How do we bring the love of God into a situation where there's been a disaster? How do we bring his care to folks who are struggling? And here's a guy who just happens to be blind. And because he's blind, he can't work. And because he can't work, he has to beg. Beggars were given a license. It's a bit like a taxi. You know, you had to kind of unscrew it from the coffin. I'm told it's like that with taxi drivers. And you get your license to beg. And you'd be given a spot, because you don't want too many beggars, you know, because it kind of, you want to space them out. And this guy is begging, and Jesus walks past, and people want to know what Jesus thinks about this. And so they're trying to say, hey, when bad things happen to someone, is it always their fault? And Jesus says, no. And just to show no, he says, do you know what? I'm going to do this. Now, I've heard it said that sometimes people would do this. This is a kind of medical thing. This is kind of like giving your kid Calpol, all right? Kid's got a headache, you give him some Calpol. There's other cheaper brands available everywhere else. But this might be recognized as something someone might do to try and help. A bit of eye salve, okay? So it's probably not quite the kind of hockaloogie and that we might have about getting spit put on the eyes. However, it might have been. And the guy might have been going, oh, for goodness sake. You know, it's not bad enough being blind. Now someone's gobbed on the ground and put some funny stuff on my eyes. And it feels a lot like that gobbing. Ah! All right? Bad day. But then this person says, and it must have said it in a kind of winsome voice, you know, because he'd have heard, because this guy's blind, he's not deaf. So he's heard the discussion, and Jesus says to him, off you go. Maybe he's encouraged by the fact Jesus says, hey, he's not blind because he's done something bad. He's just blind. He says, go wash in the pool of Siloam. So off he goes, washes in the pool of Siloam. And you know, you can imagine what it felt like, because all of you had mums, all right? And the lick and stick thing were mums. Ah! There's just something about that spit when you're getting someone rubbed off your face and it dries and it shrinks. Now, my skin chemistry may be unique, but that was a pretty icky moment, wasn't it? And if you were brought up in church, that's exactly when it happened. Because you're walking into church, and it was kind of like, ooh. Okay, for people listening on the podcast, I just licked my thumb and, you know, made a rubbing action. Makes bad radio. By the way, do you know more people listen to this online than are actually here at the moment? I have no idea. And what people in China and Germany do, welcome if you are listening from those places. But some of the stuff I say, how you understand that, I have no idea. But thank you for being here anyway. So he's there, and his eyelids are kind of scrunched up from the dried spit. And then he washes it off, and he opens his eyes, and he can see. This man was born blind. He's never seen anything in his life. Now, some of you are going, made up story. There's no way that happened. Does it happen regularly? No. Does it happen? Yeah, it does. There's some people doing the Alpha course at the moment. It's a lovely story of a Welsh lady who was in her 70s, I think it was, and when they did the thing about healing Alpha, she got her eyesight back. And she wasn't born blind, if I remember rightly. She went blind. Does that happen now and then? And you're going, that's a load of nonsense, that's rubbish. But if Jesus was who he said he was, if the analysis from the data from 3.5 years is right, that this is actually the Son of God who is responsible for the creation of the universe, then fixing eyeballs is way easier than the bigger stuff. In fact, fixing eyeballs is probably easier than getting a proud person to be humble. So this guy's eyes get fixed. And then he comes back, and some people look at him, and they go, hang on a minute. You appear to not be walking into things. Where's your white stick? You kind of look like that begging guy. And other people are saying, hey, stop the bus. By the way, you know how people say that all people believe that people resurrected? So the Jesus story about the resurrection, because they kind of expected that because they're weird and superstitious and stupid. No, they weren't. Everybody knew that dead people didn't rise from the dead. And everybody knew that blind people didn't get their sight back. That didn't happen. And so you can just see the explanation thing. And I bet you a pub in Gore Bridge would be just the same. There's Bobby. That can't be Bobby. Bobby's blind. He's not blind anymore. Must be his twin. Has he got a twin? He must have an identical twin. Bobby doesn't have a twin. He does now, because look, that guy can see. And you get that range of skepticism and you get that range of belief. Here's the thing, though. If the data analysis is correct about Jesus being the Son of God, healing someone who's blind is not that big a deal. But the trouble is, if you're going to be in that pocket that says that science is going to explain everything, you have no means of explaining what happens here, because you've just said to that whole religion faith thing, that's all bunkum. So you can't believe it. So what would Richard Dawkins do with that? He'd immediately be working away at some kind of, oh no, it must have been. And then eventually, probably quite cross, he'd say, it's rubbish. It's just designed to enslave people so they can give their money to Ian Purvis and get a drive laid. So, and if he's right, please go to B&Q on a Sunday. Don't be here. But I don't think he's right. But you see, these stories, the story in John 9:1-11, it's something that happens. How do we access this story? If we're some scientific kind of isolationist, we're saying it's just science, there's no faith the stuff about this, or even if we're a skeptical faith person, how do we access a story like this? Well, we could access it by trying to explain it away, or try and say, well, what Jesus is trying to say is I'm the light of the world, and this is a wee story that his followers kind of made up. The trouble is that when people make up stories about someone, I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, because if Jesus was the disciples' pretend friend, don't follow him. And if these are fibs about Jesus' life that are just intended to make us think that he was a great guy, that's also a very bad thing. You don't want to do that. You don't want to get messed in with some fibbing cult. But if it was true, then how's it true? How do you access the truth of that story? Well, think for a moment about how you get the information back from the Rosetta orbiter that gets the information from the Philae lander. All of that stuff, we have to trust that the instruments on the lander have sent faithful data to the orbiter, which is now sending faithful data back to a radio telescope like the Parkes dish. And it has to be accessed via radio waves. How do we access a story like this? We do it through faith. And faith is a kind of posh religious word for trust. Trust. We put our trust in God's goodness. If there's a possibility that Jesus is who he claimed to be through the data that we've received from these four perspectives on Jesus in the Gospels, then we access it through faith. And that's, faith works like this. As you come to the stories as a skeptic, all you see are things that couldn't happen. It couldn't be. But as you access it by faith, you say, well, if Jesus was who he said he was, this might be the sort of thing that he would do to demonstrate he was. And faith works like that. It works like the radio telescope. It sort of hooks onto the wavelength of what God is doing and can see that data stream of what God's doing. You may have lived in Gorebridge all your life and it's never crossed your mind that God's been up to stuff for years. The oldest bit of this church goes back to 1143. Gee whiz, they didn't even write with pencils back then, for goodness sake. There's a great verse in Romans, in this brilliant letter that Paul writes to the church in Rome. And it says this, so faith comes from hearing, and hearing the good news about Jesus Christ. So as we hear the good news about Jesus Christ, we're given an opportunity to turn our radio telescope in the direction of these stories and try and assess the data stream that's coming to us from them. Is it just baloney? Is it a made-up bit of nonsense? Or is there something in it? If it's baloney, do someone else on a Sunday and a Monday to Saturday. If there's something in it, then it's not just of marginal importance, it's of vital importance. We're going to have communion now. And We don't just meet with Jesus through the words and the scriptures and the telling of that. We also do it through bread and wine a few times a year. How does that work? How can you meet with Jesus? Through a bit of mother's pride and a bit of partially fermented wine. Well, it's kind of disappointing on both counts. I mean, it's not the best bread and it's not the best wine. I'm sorry, folks. How do you meet with Jesus through that? Because Jesus gathered his friends around and he took the bread and wine and he changed the Passover, because the Passover had a lamb, and Jesus is saying, I'm the lamb. All those lambs that were killed by the Jews to protect themselves, that's me. They're pointing to me. I'm going to die for you guys. Don't worry, it will work out fine in the end. But take the bread and wine, because that's like my body and blood, and I gave that for you. And when you eat it, that reminds you my body was broken. And when you drink it, reminds you my blood was spilled so you could be rescued. You could be set free. How the hang do you access that? With the radio telescope of faith. That's how you do it. I think that's pretty much all I have to say. I hope that made sense. God bless you for working your way through that. More details of the Rosetta Mission are available on the SA website and all sorts of news outlets. More information about Jesus of Nazareth is available in the four Gospels. I recommend you read both.